Translator's Preface. Leo Tolstoy, the greatest of Russian prose writers, was born in 1828 on the ancestral estate he inherited about 100 miles south of Moscow. After a very happy childhood and a couple of years at Kazan University, he went in 1851 to the Caucasus, where he entered the army as a cadet, not obtaining his commission as an officer in the artillery till 1854, the year the Crimean War broke out. He then applied to be transferred to that front, and from November 1854 to September 1855, when the town was abandoned, he served in the defense of Sevastopol while it was besieged by the French and English. When the war was over, he retired from the army, and in 1862 he married, having by then written his 9 stories and Tales of Army Life, to which he referred as Trials of the Pen. He had also devoted himself ardently to the education of the peasant children on his estate and in the neighborhood. When the family property was divided among his 3 brothers, his sister, and himself, his means were small, and in consequence of losses at cards, he found himself in straitened circumstances. It was natural enough, therefore, that when he married, his wife should insist on his abandoning the educational work to which he was devoted, but which instead of bringing in an income cost him money. After his marriage, he accordingly set himself the task of repairing his fortune by improving his estate, which he did very successfully, becoming so absorbed in estate management that, as he himself expressed it, he almost forgot that he was an author, and for months at a time did not soil his hand with ink or his soul with thought. A year after his marriage, however, he began his great novel, War and Peace, the first part of which was published in February 1865, and the final part in November 1869. Of War and Peace, it may be said that it stands at the crucial point where the modern novel begins. Its predecessors, and many of its successors, seem to belong almost to a prehistoric stage of the novel. If there can be said to be a dividing line between the old and the modern novel, Tolstoy marks it, unless indeed we take the earlier Richardson as doing so. Tolstoy's immediate predecessors in the development of the modern novel were the great French analytical novelists of the late 18th and early 19th centuries, Rousseau and Stendhal. Tolstoy always mentions these two when speaking of those who influenced him. He himself heralds a change in the texture of the narrative from the old dramatic method, which was still Dostoevsky's, to a new one, the point of view method. The dramatic method consists of giving the actions and words of the characters without an explanation. Tolstoy, in his earlier period, never does this. With him, the psychological explanation is the important thing. What is important is not what his people do. It is why they do it that matters. But this applies only to the early Tolstoy. His work falls into 2 distinct parts, before and after what has been called his conversion. This was not only a religious and moral conversion, it was also a literary one, involving a complete change of literary method. The latter period, however, falls outside the scope of our present subject. The first period, covering the years 1852 to 77, again falls into 2 parts, a preparatory period and a period of fulfillment. The first is the period before War and Peace. The second is the period of War and Peace and Anna Karenina. In the first period, Tolstoy was only preparing himself for his great works. His first object in his writings, then, was the formation of a certain technique of analysis by which he could lay his finger on the mechanism of the psychological preparation of human action. It is amusing to note how he reveled in the classification of various types of character, especially in his Caucasian and Sevastopol stories. He was gradually perfecting an instrument of analysis which allowed him to go far deeper than anyone before him into the lower layers of consciousness. This gives him the specious appearance of a man who was particularly near to unreasoning life, which is a very easy but very bad fallacy. In War and Peace, this instrument of analysis is fully perfected, and is only a means to an end, not an end in itself. Tolstoy placed his novel in an historical setting. This is one of the vital points of War and Peace. There have been many disputes as to the correctness of his view of Napoleon's character and actions, but besides his practical experience of war in the Russian army, he unquestionably had what is very important in dealing with history, an acute sense of the uninterrupted stream of happenings, of time. It is this placing of the family novel, based on a thoroughgoing explanatory analysis of action, in this stream of time that gives War and Peace its peculiar place in the history of the novel. Tolstoy created something that may be said to be no longer a novel. It is the open form of the novel as opposed to the closed form. Flaubert, in Madame Bovary, was bringing the closed form to perfection. It had a beginning, a middle, and an end, a single jet ending in a definite solution of the conflicts inside the novel. Tolstoy, in War and Peace, transcends the limit of the novel and does what had previously been done by the epic. Thus, War and Peace has to be put in a group not with Madame Bovary, Vanity Fair, or The Mill on the Floss, but with the Iliad, in the sense that when the novel is finished, nothing is finished. The stream of life flows on, and with the appearance of Prince Andrew's son, the novel ends on the beginning of a new life. All the time, there are openings out of the story into the world beyond. This is a thing that had never been attempted by historical novelists before Tolstoy. As for the open form, it has often been attempted, but never so successfully. In a very different way, the open form was achieved by James Joyce in Ulysses. As Tolstoy is compared with the Iliad and the Odyssey, so critics say that Joyce's novel is of a mythological nature. John Galsworthy's Forsyte Saga and Arnold Bennett's The Old Wives' Tale may also claim to belong to the category of open novels. No novel has received more enthusiastic praise both in Russia and England than War and Peace. John Galsworthy spoke of it as the greatest novel ever written, and those fine critics Percy Lubbock and E.M. Forster have been no less emphatic. In The Craft of Fiction, Lubbock says that War and Peace is a picture of life that has never been surpassed for its grandeur and its beauty. The business of the novelist is to create life, and here is life created indeed. In the whole of fiction, no scene is so continually washed by the common air free to us all as the scene of Tolstoy, the supreme genius among novelists. Pierre and Andrew and Natasha and the rest of them are the children of yesterday and today and tomorrow. There is nothing in any of them that is not of all time. To an English reader of today, it is curious, and more, it is strangely moving, to note how faithfully the creations of Tolstoy, the 19th century Russian, copy the young people of the 20th century and of England. It is all one, life in Moscow then, life in London now, provided only that it is young enough. E.M. Forster, in Aspects of the Novel, says, "No English novelist is as great as Tolstoy, that is to say, has given so complete a picture of man's life both on its domestic and heroic side. Cranford, The Heart of Midlothian, Jane Eyre, Richard Feverel, all four are little mansions, not mighty edifices, and we shall see and respect them for what they are if we stand them for an instant in the colonnades of War and Peace." Why is War and Peace not depressing? Probably because it has expanded over space as well as time, and the sense of space, until it terrifies us, is exhilarating and leaves behind it an effect like music. After one has read War and Peace for a bit, great chords begin to sound. They come from the immense area of Russia, over which episodes and characters have been scattered, from the sum total of bridges, frozen rivers, forests, roads, gardens, fields, which accumulate grandeur and sonority after we have passed them. Many novelists have the feeling of time. Very few have the sense of space, and the possession of it ranks high in Tolstoy's divine equipment. Space is the lord of war and peace, not time. As we read it, do not great chords begin to sound behind us? And when we have finished, does not every item, even the catalogue of strategies, lead a larger existence than was possible at the time? De Voguet, the greatest French authority on Russian literature, in Le Roman Russe, the Russian novel, remarks that it is easy to predict the impression that readers of War and Peace and Anna Karenina will receive. I have noticed that sequence among all those who have tasted of these books. At first, and for a fairly long time, their minds are confused, not knowing where they are being led, and they experience fatigue, or, to put it bluntly, ennui. But little by little, they are carried away and captivated by the complex play of all those interests. They secure a footing among all these people, find friends, become passionately interested in the secrets of their destinies, and on closing the book, feel real regret, like that of parting from a family that has adopted them and with whom they have lived for years. It is a faithful picture of life, the experience of a traveler thrown among a society new to him, constraint and boredom at first, then curiosity, and at last a firm attachment. I admit sotto voce that I know nothing superior to it in any literature. What de Voguet there says of the difficulty readers encounter when starting on a book is certainly sometimes true. And this is so, partly because many people have forgotten the incidents of Napoleon's early career which were discussed at Anna Scherer's soiree, besides which the number of Russian names mentioned proves perplexing. In the present edition, however, both these difficulties are mitigated, for the editor's notes supply the information necessary to enable the reader to understand the reference to the Duc d'Enghien's murder and to the other events alluded to, while the table which gives the names of the principal characters arranged in order of appearance should render it easier for readers to remember who is who. Note, this table and another more inclusive one will be given, with spellings, later on in this record. Tolstoy's skill in driving his teams, the domestic and the historic, without letting them get entangled, is very remarkable. He originally intended to tell the story of the Decembrist movement which culminated in the Emeute of 1825, and which was the disastrous forerunner of the Back to the People movement of the 70s, and the revolutionary movements which eventually culminated in the downfall of the Tsardom and the revolution of 1917. But while studying the Decembrist conspiracy, Tolstoy's thoughts went back to the period during which it had ripened, to the French invasion in 1812, and further back still to the Russian reverses which preceded that. When dealing with the revolutionary spirit and the secret Masonic movement in which it was germinating, he had to reckon with the censor, who had mutilated his first story, The Raid, as well as his Sevastopol sketches. This consideration had a hampering effect on the latter portion of the novel, which extends from 1805, the year of Austerlitz, to the days when the influence of the Decembrist movement was already being felt. The reader may wonder why Tolstoy was so interested in the Masonic movement, and what connection it has with the main thread of the novel. In reality, he was profoundly sensitive to the fundamental wrongness and consequent rottenness of the system under which everything depended on the wish and whim of an autocrat, and he felt a keen interest in the group which, though often rashly and with mixed motives, aimed at overthrowing the established order and replacing it by a better one. That this is not clearly expressed in the novel was no doubt due to the censor. I feel almost ashamed, however, to allude to such a minor flaw in so great a story, and prefer to conclude this preface by quoting a remark made by a Chicago heiress, Miss Mary Landon Baker, who said, "I should like to live my life over again, in order to have once again the pleasure of reading War and Peace for the first time." The notes form an important feature of this edition, particularly, though not exclusively, for readers interested in the historical events mentioned. A number of political affairs are alluded to in the opening pages of the story, and for that reason, the first notes immediately follow this preface. Aylmer Maude. Notes to the opening chapters. Books 1, 2, and 3 of War and Peace deal with the campaign waged by Russia against the French in Austria, which ended with the Battle of Austerlitz. After the coup d'état of 18th Brumaire, November 9, 1799, Napoleon, from a general in the service of the Revolutionary Directorate, had become chief ruler of France under the title of First Consul. 3 years later, he became chief ruler for life, and 2 years after that, in December 1804, was proclaimed Emperor of the French. Having already in his first Italian campaign in 1796-97 made himself, by the Treaty of Campo Formio, master of northern Italy and the left bank of the Rhine, he strengthened and increased that position by the Second Italian War in 1800. At first, he encountered little serious opposition. Prussia and Austria, the neighbors most nearly concerned in his seizures, having already been repeatedly defeated, were afraid of him, and by the partition of Poland found compensation for the territories he seized. Only two important opponents faced Napoleon, England and Russia. The young Tsar, Alexander I, realized the danger to Europe of Napoleon's ambitions, but was hampered by the inertia of Prussia and Austria, and at first proceeded cautiously, so that Napoleon first prepared to attack England. He seized Hanover, a possession of the British crown, and in 1803 formed a great fortified camp at Boulogne, where he could concentrate an army. In alliance with Spain, he prepared a large fleet to cover the Boulogne expedition and make an invasion of England possible. The efforts of Admiral Villeneuve, who was to have brought a fleet into the Channel, were, however, unsuccessful, and his fleet was destroyed by Nelson at Trafalgar in 1805. In 1804, an event had occurred which produced a great impression on the European courts and inclined them to action against Napoleon. Investigation of the Cadoudal-Pichegru conspiracy against Napoleon disclosed a connection with the Bourbons and, as was wrongly supposed, with their heir, L.A.M. de Bourbon-Condé, Duc d'Enghien. Napoleon had the Duke seized on Baden territory by French-mounted gendarmes who crossed the Rhine secretly and brought him to the castle of Vincennes near Paris, where he was shot after an irregular trial by a commission of French colonels acting under pressure. In all the courts of Europe, talk of the martyrdom of the just one was rife. But Alexander I was the only ruler who took action. The Russian ambassador left Paris, and the French ambassador left Petersburg. The conversations in June 1805 in Anna Scherer's salon, with which War and Peace begins, are full of indignation against Napoleon on account of this execution. He is spoken of as a murderer, as Antichrist, and a usurper. No one speaks of him as emperor, though he had assumed the throne half a year previously. They did not even speak of him as Napoleon, but merely as Bonaparte, or even Buonaparte, with ironic reference to his not being French, but Corsican by birth. In June 1805, this villain had added to the villainies which revolted Europe. First, in March, he had formed a kingdom of Italy and had himself crowned King of Italy at Milan, and a little later he annexed the Republic of Genoa to France and formed the Principality of Lucca, which he gave to his sister Elisa and her husband. This is referred to as fresh news in the first sentence of the book. Anna Scherer wants Prince Vasily to say that there will be war with France. Her anticipation was correct. The negotiations Alexander I had begun with the other European powers were drawing to a head. In March, a treaty negotiated by Novosiltsev had been concluded with England, which aimed at compelling Napoleon to withdraw his armies from Hanover and Italy and to acknowledge the independence of Holland and Switzerland. In May, General Wintzingerode, had been sent to Austria with a plan of action by a fresh alliance of England, Russia, Sweden, Austria, and Naples. Prussia, which hesitated, was to be drawn in almost by force. The details of this plan are given in Book 1, Chapter 15, where old Bolkonski and Prince Andrew discuss it. Napoleon, having learned of the preparations against him, and wishing to destroy the coalition, unexpectedly proposed peace to England. England asked Alexander to act as intermediary, and the latter sent Novosiltsev to Paris to act as his representative. But on reaching Berlin in June, Novosiltsev heard of the seizure of Genoa and did not proceed to Paris. War was now inevitable, and it soon broke out, though Prussia, whose ministers Haugwitz and Hardenburg are referred to, still avoided it. In the first draft of the novel, Tolstoy mentions the Abbé Piattoli by his real name, but afterwards changed it to Abbé Morio, assigning him a more important part. Piattoli had been at one time tutor to Adam Czartoryski, a friend and advisor of Alexander I, and in close touch with him at that period. Piattoli's project of perpetual peace, in which a prominent position was allotted to Russia, interested Petersburg for a while. It had some influence on Alexander's later plan of a holy alliance, and should be counted among the many projects and suggestions that gradually led up to the League of Nations. The old Prince Bolkonski, described in a later chapter, was drawn from Tolstoy's grandfather, Prince N.S. Volkonski, a general of Catherine the Great's time. Tolstoy's father married his only daughter. Volkonski had no son, and Prince Andrew of the novel is a type created by Tolstoy, to which he attributed some aspects of himself, as well as some characteristics of his elder brother, Sergius Tolstoy. Another side of Tolstoy is allotted in the novel to Pierre. Aylmer Maud. Dates of principal historical events. These dates are old style. To arrive at the new style date, simply add 12 days. For instance, October 11th, old style, is October 23rd, new style, and October 30th, old style, is November 11th, new style. 1805. October 11th. Kutuzov inspects regiment near Braunau. Le malheureux Mack arrives. October 23rd, the Russian army crosses the Enns. October 24th, fight at Amstetten. October 28th, the Russian army crosses the Danube. October 30th, defeats Mortier at Dürrenstein. November 4th, Napoleon writes to Murat from Schönbrunn. November 4th, Battle of Schöngraben. November 19th, the Council of War at Austerlitz. November 20th, Battle of Austerlitz. 1807. January 27th, Battle of Preußisch Eylau. June 2nd, Battle of Friedland. June 13th, the Emperors meet at Tilsit. 1812, May 17th, Napoleon leaves Dresden. June 12th, Napoleon crosses the Niemen and enters Russia. June 14th, Alexander sends Balashov to Napoleon. July 13th, the Pavlograd Hussars in action at Ostrovna. August 4th, Alpatych at Smolensk hears distant firing. August 5th, bombardment of Smolensk. August 7th, Prince Nicholas Bolkonski leaves Bald Hills for Boguchárovo. August 8th, Kutuzov appointed commander-in-chief. August 10th, Prince Andrew's column abreast of Bald Hills. August 17th, Kutuzov reaches Tsarevo Zaymishche and takes command of the army. August 17th, Nicholas Rostov rides to Boguchárovo. August 24th, Battle of the Shevardino Redoubt. August 26th, Battle of Borodino. September 1st, Kutuzov orders retreat through Moscow. October 6th. Battle of Tarutino. October 6th, 7th, and 8th, the French leave Moscow. October 12th, Battle of Malo Yaroslavets. October 21st, Cossacks harry the French at Vyazma. October 28th to November 2nd, the French at Smolensk. November 4th to 8th, battles at Krasnoye. November 9th, Ney, with rear guard, reaches Orsha. November 14th to 16th, crossing of the Beryozina. November 23rd, Napoleon abandons the army at Smorgonyi. December 6th, he reaches Paris. The principal characters arranged in family groups. The Bezukhovs, B-E-Z-U-K-H-O-V, Count Cyril Bezukhov, a wealthy nobleman of Catherine the Great's time, Pierre, his son, who, legitimized after his father's death, becomes Count Bezukhov, the central character of the novel, Princess Katiche, C-A-T-I-C-H-E, Pierre's cousin, the Rostovs, R-O-S-T-O-V, Count Ilya, I-L-Y-A, Rostov, a wealthy nobleman, Countess Natalie Rostova, his wife, Count Nicholas Rostov, their elder son who goes into the army as a cadet, Count Peter Rostov, their younger son, also called Petya, P-E-T-Y-A, Countess Vera Rostova, their elder daughter, Countess Natalie Rostova, their younger daughter, the central female character, also called Natasha, N-A-T-A-S-H-A, Sonya, S-O-N-Y-A, a poor niece of the Rostovs, and Lieutenant Alphonse Karlovich Berg, B-E-R-G, an officer who marries Viera. The Bolkonskis, B-O-L-K-O-N-S-K-I. Prince Nicholas Andreevich Bolkonsky, a retired general. Andreevich, A-N-D-R-E-E-V-I-C-H. Prince Andrew Bolkonsky, his son, a member of Kutuzov's staff. Princess Mary Bolkonskaya, his daughter. Princess Elizabeth Bolkonskaya, Prince Andrew's wife, called the most fascinating woman in Petersburg, also known as Lise, L-I-S-E. Prince Nicholas Andreevich Bolkonsky, Prince Andrew's son, also called Koko, K-O-K-O. The Kuragins, K-U-R-A-G-I-N. Prince Vasily, V-A-S-I-L-I, Kuragin, an elderly nobleman. Prince Ippolit Kuragin, H-I-P-P-O-L-Y-T-E, his weak-minded elder son. Prince Anatole Kuragin, A-N-A-T-O-L-E, his profligate younger son. Princess Hélène Kuragina, H-E-L-E-N-E, his daughter, called the beautiful Hélène. The Drubetskoys, D-R-U-B-E-T-S-K-O-Y. Princess Anna Mikhailovna Drubetskaya, M-I-K-H-A-Y-L-O-V-N-A, an impoverished noblewoman. Prince Boris, B-O-R-I-S, Drubetskoy, her son, who enters the army, also called Bori, B-O-R-Y, Julie Karagina, K-A-R-A-G-I-N-A, an heiress who later marries Boris. Characters in War and Peace arranged in order of their appearance. A note on Russian names and titles of Russian aristocratic rank. The suffixes Ovich, O-V-I-C-H, Evich, E-V-I-C-H, Ich, I-C-H, or Y-C-H, at the end of a Russian name, mean son of. The suffixes Ovna, O-V-N-A, and Evna, E-V-N-A, mean daughter of. Thus, Tolstoy's full name in Russian is Count Lev Nikolaevich Tolstoy, Nikolaevich is Tolstoy's patronymic. This indicates that Lev, or Leo, is the son of Nikolai, or Nicholas, Tolstoy. Frequently, a character is referred to by his own first name, followed by his patronymic, sometimes by the patronymic alone. The Russians also add suffixes to first names to express endearment, as when they refer to Natasha as Natashenka. In Imperial Russia, as elsewhere in Europe, a prince ranked above a count. But by the beginning of the 19th century, certain princely families had become impoverished, so that a man's place in the hierarchy of aristocracy was not necessarily consistent with his wealth and power. Book 1. Introduced at Anna Scherer's Soiree, St. Petersburg, Chapter 1. Anna Pavlovna Scherer, S-C-H-E-R-E-R, maid of honor to the Dowager Empress Maria Fyodorovna, Prince Vasily Kuragin, an elderly nobleman, Princess Elena Kuragina, his daughter, the beautiful Elena, Princess Elizabeth, Lise Bolkonskaya, Prince Andrew's wife, called the most fascinating woman in Petersburg, Prince Ippolit Kuragin, Prince Vasily's weak-minded elder son, Pierre, Count Cyril Bezukhov's son, who, when legitimized after his father's death, becomes the fantastically wealthy Count Bezukhov, Prince Andrew Bolkonsky, Prince Nicholas Bolkonsky's son, one of the major characters in the novel. He is scion of a wealthy landowning family, noted for its military achievements. Note, Pierre and Andrew are the two central male figures of War and Peace, and are believed to embody some of the characteristics of Leo Tolstoy himself and his own kinsmen. The author of War and Peace made great use of historical and military records and family archives. Princess Anna Mikhailovna Drubetskaya, an elderly lady of a good but impoverished family. Introduced at the party at Anatole's house, St. Petersburg, Chapter 3. Prince Anatole Kuragin, Prince Vasily's profligate younger son, Dolokhov, D-O-L-O-K-H-O-V, an officer of the Semyonov regiment who lives with Anatole, supposedly a combination of Count Theodore Tolstoy, a famous traveler, and R.I. Dorokhov, a reckless daredevil of the period of War and Peace. Introduced at the Rostov's Name Day Party, Moscow, Chapters 4 and 5. Countess Natalie Rostova, Count Ilya Rostov's wife, Count Ilya Rostov, a wealthy nobleman of the upper aristocracy, with large estates in city and country, supposedly patterned after Tolstoy's grandfather, Count Ilya A. Tolstoy, Julie Karagina, an heiress, Countess Natalie or Natasha Rostova, the Rostov's younger daughter, the major female character, supposedly patterned after Tolstoy's youngest sister-in-law, Tatiana Behrs, B-E-H-R-S. Prince Boris or Bori Drubetskoy, Anna Mikhailovna's son. Count Nicholas Rostov, the Rostov's elder son, one of the central characters, supposedly patterned after Tolstoy's father, Count Nicholas Tolstoy. Sonia, a poor niece of the Rostovs, supposedly patterned after Tolstoy's aunt, who supervised his education. Count Peter or Petya Rostov, the Rostov's younger son. Countess Vera Rostova, the Rostov's elder daughter, supposedly patterned after Lisa Behrs, the older of Tolstoy's two sisters-in-law. Introduced in the house where Count Bezukhov lies dying, Moscow, Chapter 6, Princess Katish, or Catherine Semyonovna, Pierre's cousin. Introduced at the Rostov's dinner party, Moscow, Chapters 8 through 10, Dmitri Vasilievich, V-A-S-I-L-E-V-I-C-H, Count Ilya Rostov's estate manager, Peter Nikolaevich Shinshin, S-H-I-N-S-H-I-N, Countess Rostova's cousin, Alphonse Karlovich Berg, an officer of the guards engaged to Vera Rostova, Maria Dmitrievna Akhrosimova, A-K-H-R-O-S-I-M-O-V-A, called Le Terrible Dragon, the Terrible Dragon. Chapter 12, Count Cyril Bezukhov, Pierre's father. Introduced at Volkonsky's Bald Hills estate, about 40 miles northeast of Smolensk, chapters 14 through 16, Prince Nicholas Andreevich Bolkonsky, a retired general of the higher aristocracy, Prince Andrew's father, supposedly patterned after Prince N. Volkonsky, Tolstoy's grandfather. Princess Mary Bolkonskaya, his daughter, supposedly patterned after Tolstoy's mother. Mademoiselle Bourienne, Bourienne, her French companion. Tichon, Tichon, Prince Nicholas's attendant. Book 2, introduced at the review near Braunau, 139 miles east-northeast of Prague, Chapter 1, Michael Ilarionovich Kutuzov, K-U-T-U-Z-O-V, elderly commander-in-chief of the Russian army, called back to active duty to meet the threat of Napoleon's invasion. Prince Nesvitsky, N-E-S-V-I-T-S-K-I, a staff officer. Captain Timohin, T-I-M-O-K-H-I-N, an army officer. Zherkov, Z-H-E-R-K-O-V, and Hussar Cornet. Introduced at Kutuzov's headquarters near Braunau, Chapter 2, Kozlovsky, K-O-Z-L-O-V-S-K-I, Kutuzov's aide-de-camp, Baron Mack von Leiberich, M-A-C-K, von L-E-I-B-E-R-I-C-H, an Austrian general. Introduced to Nicholas Rostov's regiment in Salzeneck, 2 miles from Braunau, chapters 3 and 4, Vasily or Vaska, V-A-S-K-A, Dmitrich Denisov, D-E-N-I-S-O-V, an officer friend of Nicholas Rostov. Lavrushka, L-A-V-R-U-S-H-K-A, Denisov's orderly, later Nicholas Rostov's. Lieutenant Telyanin, T-E-L-Y-A-N-I-N, a thieving army officer. Chapter 7, Bilibin, B-I-L-I-B-I-N, in the diplomatic service. Chapter 9, Francis II, Holy Roman Emperor, later Emperor of Austria. Chapter 10, Peter Ivanovich Bagration, B-A-G-R-A-T-I-O-N, commander of the Russian army. Chapter 11, Captain Tushin, T-U-S-H-I-N, an army officer. Book 3, introduced at Bald Hills, Chapter 2, Yakov Alpatych, Y-A-K-O-V, A-L-P-A-T-Y-C-H, Prince Nicholas Bolkonsky's estate overseer. Introduced at the army review at Olmütz, 67 miles northeast of Brünn, Chapter 7, Alexander I, Tsar of Russia. Introduced at Olmütz, Chapter 8, Prince Yuri Dolgorukov, Y-U-R-I, D-O-L-G-O-R-U-K-O-V, an adjutant general. Introduced at Battle of Austerlitz, 15 miles east of Brünn, Chapter 13, Napoleon Bonaparte, Emperor of the French. Book 4, introduced at the English Club dinner, Moscow, Chapter 3, Count F.V. Rostopchin, R-O-S-T-O-P-C-H-I-N, Governor-General of Moscow. Alexander Dmitrievich Balashov, B-A-L-A-S-H-E-V, an adjutant-general. Chapter 9, Prince Nicholas or Koko Andreevich Bolkonsky, Prince Andrew's son. Book 5, Chapter 1, Joseph Alexeyevich Bazdeyev, V-A-Z-D-E-E-V, a leading Freemason. Book 6, introduced at Count Kochubey's, St. Petersburg, Chapter 2, Alexey, A-L-E-X-E-Y, Andreevich Arakcheyev, A-R-A-K-C-H-E-E-V, Minister of War, also known as Sila Andreevich. Michael Mikhailovich Speransky, S-P-E-R-A-N-S-K-I, Secretary of State. Book 7, introduced at the hunt on the Rostov's country estate at Otradnoye, O-T-R-A-D-N-O-E, chapters 3 through 6. Daniel, the Rostov's head huntsman. Michael Nikanorovich, N-I-K-A-N-O-R-O-V-I-C-H, known as Uncle, a distant relative of the Rostovs, Nastasya Ivanovna, Nastasya Ivanovna, the Rostovs' buffoon, Ilyagin, Ilyagin, the Rostovs' neighbor. Chapter 11, Pelageya Danilovna Melyukova, Pelageya, P-E-L-A-G-E-Y-A, Melyukova, M-E-L-Y-U-K-O-V-A, the Rostovs' neighbor. Book 9, introduced to Nicholas Rostov's regiment, chapters 12 and 13, Ilyin, I-L-Y-I-N, Nicholas Rostov's protégé, Mary Hendrikhovna, H-E-N-D-R-I-K-H-O-V-N-A, wife of the regimental doctor. Book 10, chapter 4, Ferapontov, F-E-R-A-P-O-N-T-O-V, an innkeeper at Smolensk. Introduced at Voguchárovo, B-O-G-U-C-H-A-R-O-V-O, between Bald Hills and Moscow, chapters 9 through 14, Dron, D-R-O-N, the village elder of Boguchárovo, Karp, K-A-R-P, a villager of Boguchárovo. Book 11, introduced at Bazdeyev's house, Moscow, chapters 9 through 14, Makar, M-A-K-A-R, Alexeyevich Bazdeyev, B-A-Z-D-E-E-V, Joseph Bazdeyev's half-insane brother, Captain Rambal, R-A-M-B-A-L-L-E, a French officer, Morel, M-O-R-E-L, Rambal's orderly. Book 12, introduced in the prison with Pierre, Moscow, Chapter 3, Platon Karataev, P-L-A-T-O-N, K-A-R-A-T-A-E-V, a captured Russian peasant soldier. Book 14, introduced with Denisov's guerrillas near Mikulino on the road to Smolensk, Chapter 2, Esaul, E-S-A-U-L, Michael Feoklitich, F-E-O-K-L-I-T-Y-C-H, a Cossack guerrilla. Tichon Shcherbati, T-I-K-H-O-N, S-H-C-H-E-R-B-A-T-Y, a peasant guerrilla. First epilogue, introduced at Bolkonsky's, now Mary Rostova's, Bald Hills estate, Chapter 2. Count Andrew Rostov, Nicholas Rostov's son, Countess Natasha Rostova, Nicholas Rostov's daughter. 1805, Book 1. Chapter 1, Anna Scherer's Soiree.
Well, Prince, so Genoa and Lucca are now just family estates of the Buonapartes. But I warn you, if you don't tell me that this means war, if you still try to defend the infamies and horrors perpetrated by that Antichrist, I really believe he is Antichrist, I will have nothing more to do with you, and you're no longer my friend, no longer my faithful slave, as you call yourself. But how do you do? I see I've frightened you. Sit down and tell me all the news. It was in July 1805, and the speaker was the well-known Anna Pavlovna Scherer, maid of honor and favorite of the Empress Maria Fyodorovna. With these words, she greeted Prince Vasily Kuragin, a man of high rank and importance, who was the first to arrive at her reception. Anna Pavlovna had had a cough for some days. She was, as she said, suffering from la grippe, grippe being then a new word in St. Petersburg, used only by the elite. Note, St. Petersburg, now Leningrad. All her invitations, without exception, written in French and delivered by a scarlet-liveried footman that morning, ran as follows. If you have nothing better to do, Count or Prince, and if the prospect of spending an evening with a poor invalid is not too terrible, I shall be very charmed to see you tonight between 7 and 10. Annette Scherer.
Heavens, what a virulent attack, replied the Prince, not in the least disconcerted by this reception.
He had just entered, wearing an embroidered court uniform, knee breeches and shoes, and had stars on his breast, and a serene expression on his flat face. He spoke in that refined French in which our grandfathers not only spoke, but thought, and with the gentle, patronizing intonation natural to a man of importance who had grown old in society and at court. He went up to Anna Pavlovna, kissed her hand, presenting to her his bald, scented, and shining head, and complacently seated himself on the sofa.
First of all, dear friend, tell me how you are. Set your friend's mind at rest, said he, without altering his tone, beneath the politeness and affected sympathy of which indifference and even irony could be discerned.
Can one be well while suffering morally? Can one be calm in times like these if one has any feeling? Said Anna Pavlovna. You are staying the whole evening, I hope.
And the fete at the English ambassador's? Well, today is Wednesday. I must put in an appearance there, said the prince. My daughter is coming for me to take me there.
I thought today's fete had been cancelled. I confess all these festivities and fireworks are becoming wearisome.
If they had known that you wished it, the entertainment would have been put off, said the prince, who, like a wound-up clock, by force of habit, said things he did not even wish to be believed.
Oh, don't tease. Well, and what has been decided about Novosiltsev's dispatch? You know everything.
What can one say about it? Replied the prince in a cold, listless tone. What has been decided? They have decided that Buonaparte has burnt his boats, and I believe that we are ready to burn ours.
Prince Vasily always spoke languidly, like an actor repeating a stale part. Anna Pavlovna Scherer, on the contrary, despite her 40 years, overflowed with animation and impulsiveness. To be an enthusiast had become her social vocation, and sometimes, even when she did not feel like it, she became enthusiastic in order not to disappoint the expectations of those who knew her. The subdued smile, which, though it did not suit her faded features, always played round her lips, expressed, as in a spoiled child, a continual consciousness of her charming defect, which she neither wished, nor could, nor considered it necessary to correct. In the midst of a conversation on political matters, Anna Pavlovna burst out, "Oh, don't speak to me of Austria. Perhaps I don't understand things, but Austria never has wished and does not wish for war. She's betraying us. Russia alone must save Europe. Our gracious sovereign recognizes his high vocation and will be true to it. That is the one thing I have faith in. Our good and wonderful sovereign has to perform the noblest role on earth, and he is so virtuous and noble that God will not forsake him. He will fulfill his vocation and crush the hydra of revolution, which has become more terrible than ever in the person of this murderer and villain. We alone must avenge the blood of the just one. Whom, I ask you, can we rely on? England, with her commercial spirit, will not and cannot understand the Emperor Alexander's loftiness of soul. She has refused to evacuate Malta. She wanted to find, and still seeks, some secret motive in our actions. What answer did Novosiltsev get? None. The English have not understood, and cannot understand, the self-abnegation of our Emperor, who wants nothing for himself, but only desires the good of mankind. And what have they promised? Nothing. And what little they have promised, they will not perform. Prussia has always declared that Buonaparte is invincible and that all Europe is powerless before him. And I don't believe a word that Hardenburg says, or Haugwitz either. This famous Prussian neutrality is just a trap. I have faith only in God and the lofty destiny of our adored monarch. He will save Europe. She suddenly paused, smiling at her own impetuosity.
I think, said the prince with a smile, that if you had been sent instead of our dear Wintzingerode, you would have captured the King of Prussia's consent by assault. You are so eloquent. Will you give me a cup of tea?
In a moment. Apropos, she added, becoming calm again, I'm expecting two very interesting men tonight, le Vicomte de Mortemart, who is connected with the Montmorencys through the Rohans, one of the best French families. He's one of the genuine émigrés, the good ones. And also the Abbé Morio. Do you know that profound thinker? He's been received by the Emperor. Had you heard?
I shall be delighted to meet them, said the prince. But tell me, he added with studied carelessness, as if it had only just occurred to him, though the question he was about to ask was the chief motive of his visit, is it true that the Dowager Empress wants Baron Funke to be appointed first secretary at Vienna? The Baron, by all accounts, is a poor creature.
Prince Vasily wished to obtain this post for his son, but others were trying through the Dowager Empress Maria Fyodorovna to secure it for the Baron.
Anna Pavlovna almost closed her eyes to indicate that neither she nor anyone else had a right to criticize what the Empress desired or was pleased with. "Baron Funke has been recommended to the Dowager Empress by her sister," was all she said in a dry and mournful tone. As she named the Empress, Anna Pavlovna's face suddenly assumed an expression of profound and sincere devotion and respect, mingled with sadness. And this occurred every time she mentioned her illustrious patroness. She added that Her Majesty had deigned to show Baron Funke beaucoup d'estime, and again her face clouded over with sadness. The prince was silent and looked indifferent. But with the womanly and courtier-like quickness and tact habitual to her, Anna Pavlovna wished both to rebuke him for daring to speak as he had done of a man recommended to the Empress, and at the same time to console him. So she said, "Now about your family. Do you know that since your daughter came out, everyone has been enraptured by her? They say she is amazingly beautiful." The prince bowed to signify his respect and gratitude. "I often think," she continued after a short pause, drawing nearer to the prince and smiling amiably at him as if to show that political and social topics were ended and the time had come for intimate conversation, "I often think how unfairly sometimes the joys of life are distributed. Why has fate given you two such splendid children? I don't speak of Anatole, your youngest. I don't like him," she added in a tone admitting of no rejoinder and raising her eyebrows. "Two such charming children, and really you appreciate them less than anyone, and so you don't deserve to have them." And she smiled her ecstatic smile. "I can't help it," said the prince. "Lavater would have said I lack the bump of paternity." Note: Johann Caspar Lavater, 1741 to 1801, was a Swiss clergyman and physician who related physiognomy to mental attributes. "Oh, don't joke. I mean to have a serious talk with you. Do you know, Prince," said Anna Pavlovna, "I'm dissatisfied with your younger son. Between ourselves," and her face assumed its melancholy expression, "he was mentioned at Her Majesty's, and you were pitied." Prince Vasily Kuragin answered nothing, but she looked at him significantly, awaiting a reply. He frowned. "What would you have me do?" he said at last. "You know I did all a father could for their education, and they've both turned out fools. Hippolyte is at least a quiet fool, but Anatole is an active one. That is the only difference between them." He said this smiling in a way more natural and animated than usual, so that the wrinkles round his mouth very clearly revealed something unexpectedly coarse and unpleasant. "And why are children born to such men as you? If you were not a father, there would be nothing I could reproach you with," said Anna Pavlovna, looking up pensively. "I am your faithful slave, and to you alone I can confess that my children are the bane of my life. It is the cross I have to bear. That is how I explain it to myself. It can't be helped." He said no more, but expressed his resignation to cruel fate by a gesture. Anna Pavlovna meditated. "Have you never thought of marrying your prodigal son Anatole?" she asked. "They say old maids have a mania for matchmaking, and though I don't feel that weakness in myself as yet, I know a little person who's very unhappy with her father. She's a relation of yours, Princess Mary Bolkonskaya." Prince Vasily did not reply, though with the quickness of memory and perception befitting a man of the world, he indicated by a movement of the head that he was considering this information. "Do you know," he said at last, evidently unable to check the sad current of his thoughts, "that Anatole is costing me 40,000 rubles a year? And," he went on after a pause, "what will it be in 5 years if he goes on like this?" Presently he added, "That's what we fathers have to put up with. Is this princess of yours rich?" "Her father is very rich and stingy. He lives in the country. He's the well-known Prince Bolkonski who had to retire from the army under the late emperor and was nicknamed the King of Prussia. He's very clever, but eccentric and a bore. The poor girl's very unhappy. She has a brother. I think you know him. He married Lise Meinen lately. He's an aide-de-camp of Kutuzov's and will be here tonight." "Listen, dear Annette," said the prince, suddenly taking Anna Pavlovna's hand and for some reason drawing it downwards. arrange that affair for me, and I shall always be your most devoted slave. Slave with an F, as a village elder of mine writes in his reports. She is rich and of good family, and that's all I want. And with the familiarity and easy grace peculiar to him, he raised the maid of honor's hand to his lips, kissed it, and swung it to and fro as he lay back in his armchair, looking in another direction. "Attendez," said Anna Pavlovna, reflecting. "I'll speak to Lise, young Bolkonsky's wife, this very evening, and perhaps the thing can be arranged. It shall be on your family's behalf that I'll start my apprenticeship as old maid." Anna Pavlovna's drawing room was gradually filling. The highest Petersburg society was assembled there, people differing widely in age and character, but alike in the social circle to which they belonged. Prince Vasily's daughter, the beautiful Hélène, came to take her father to the ambassador's entertainment. She wore a ball dress and her badge as maid of honor. The youthful little Princess Bolkonskaya, note, sister-in-law of the Princess Mary Bolkonskaya just mentioned, the youthful little Princess Bolkonskaya, known as la femme la plus séduisante de Pétersbourg, the most fascinating woman in Petersburg, was also there. She had been married during the previous winter, and being pregnant did not go to any large gatherings, but only to small receptions. Prince Vasily's son, Hippolyte, had come with Mortemart, whom he introduced. The Abbé Moriot and many others had also come. To each new arrival, Anna Pavlovna said, "You have not yet seen my aunt," or, "You do not know my aunt," and very gravely conducted him or her to a little old lady wearing large bows of ribbon in her cap, who had come sailing in from another room as soon as the guests began to arrive. And slowly turning her eyes from the visitor to her aunt, Anna Pavlovna mentioned each one's name and then left them. Each visitor performed the ceremony of greeting this old aunt, whom not one of them knew, not one of them wanted to know, not one of them cared about. Anna Pavlovna observed these greetings with mournful and solemn interest and silent approval. The aunt spoke to each of them in the same words about their health and her own, and the health of Her Majesty, who, thank God, was better today. And each visitor, though politeness prevented his showing impatience, left the old woman with a sense of relief at having performed a vexatious duty, and did not return to her the whole evening. The young Princess Bolkonskaya had brought some work in a gold-embroidered velvet bag. Her pretty little upper lip, on which a delicate dark down was just perceptible, was too short for her teeth, but it lifted all the more sweetly, and was especially charming when she occasionally drew it down to meet the lower lip. As is always the case with a thoroughly attractive woman, her defect, the shortness of her upper lip and her half-open mouth, seemed to be her own special and peculiar form of beauty. Everyone brightened at the sight of this pretty young woman, so soon to become a mother, so full of life and health, and carrying her burden so lightly. Old men and dull, dispirited young ones who looked at her, after being in her company and talking to her a little while, felt as if they too were becoming like her, full of life and health. All who talked to her, and at each word saw her bright smile and the constant gleam of her white teeth, thought that they were in a specially amiable mood that day. The little princess went round the table with quick, short, swaying steps, her work-bag on her arm, and, gaily spreading out her dress, sat down on a sofa near the silver samovar, as if all she was doing was a pleasure to herself and to all around her. "I have brought my work," said she in French, displaying her bag and addressing all present. "Mind, Annette, I hope you have not played a wicked trick on me," she added, turning to her hostess. "You wrote that it was to be quite a small reception, and just see how badly I am dressed." And she spread out her arms to show her short-waisted, lace-trimmed, dainty gray dress, girdled with a broad ribbon just below the breast. "Soyez tranquille, Lise. You will always be prettier than anyone else," replied Anna Pavlovna. "You know," said the princess in the same tone of voice and still in French, turning to a general, "my husband is deserting me. He's going to get himself killed. Tell me what this wretched war is for," she added, addressing Prince Vasily, and without waiting for an answer, she turned to speak to his daughter, the beautiful Hélène. "What a delightful woman this little princess is," said Prince Vasily to Anna Pavlovna. One of the next arrivals was a stout, heavily built young man with close-cropped hair, spectacles, the light-colored breeches fashionable at that time, a very high ruffle, and a brown dress coat. This stout young man was an illegitimate son of Count Bezukhov, a well-known grandee of Catherine's time, who now lay dying in Moscow. The young man had not yet entered either the military or civil service, as he had only just returned from abroad where he had been educated, and this was his first appearance in society. Anna Pavlovna greeted him with a nod she accorded to the lowest hierarchy in her drawing-room. But in spite of this lowest-grade greeting, a look of anxiety and fear, as at the sight of something too large and unsuited to the place, came over her face when she saw Pierre enter. Though he was certainly rather bigger than the other men in the room, her anxiety could only have reference to the clever, though shy, but observant and natural expression which distinguished him from everyone else in that drawing-room. "It is very good of you, Monsieur Pierre, to come and visit a poor invalid," said Anna Pavlovna, exchanging an alarmed glance with her aunt as she conducted him to her. Pierre murmured something unintelligible and continued to look round as if in search of something. On his way to the aunt, he bowed to the little princess with a pleased smile, as to an intimate acquaintance. Anna Pavlovna's alarm was justified, for Pierre turned away from the aunt without waiting to hear her speech about Her Majesty's health. Anna Pavlovna, in dismay, detained him with the words, "Do you know the Abbé Morio? He is a most interesting man." "Yes, I have heard of his scheme for perpetual peace, and it is very interesting, but hardly feasible."
"You think so?"
rejoined Anna Pavlovna in order to say something and get away to attend to her duties as hostess. But Pierre now committed a reverse act of impoliteness. First he had left a lady before she had finished speaking to him, and now he continued to speak to another who wished to get away. With his head bent and his big feet spread apart, he began explaining his reasons for thinking the Abbé's plan chimerical.
"We will talk of it later," said Anna Pavlovna with a smile.
And having got rid of this young man who did not know how to behave, she resumed her duties as hostess and continued to listen and watch, ready to help at any point where the conversation might happen to flag. As the foreman of a spinning mill, when he has set the hands to work, goes round and notices here a spindle that has stopped, or there one that creaks or makes more noise than it should, and hastens to check the machine or set it in proper motion, so Anna Pavlovna moved about her drawing-room, approaching now a silent, now a too noisy group, and by a word or slight rearrangement kept the conversational machine in steady, proper, and regular motion. But amid these cares, her anxiety about Pierre was evident. She kept an anxious watch on him when he approached the group round Mortemart to listen to what was being said there, and again when he passed to another group whose centre was the Abbé. Pierre had been educated abroad, and this reception at Anna Pavlovna's was the first he had attended in Russia. He knew that all the intellectual lights of Petersburg were gathered there, and, like a child in a toy shop, did not know which way to look, afraid of missing any clever conversation that was to be heard. Seeing the self-confident and refined expression on the faces of those present, he was always expecting to hear something very profound. At last he came up to Morio. Here the conversation seemed interesting, and he stood waiting for an opportunity to express his own views, as young people are fond of doing. Anna Pavlovna's reception was in full swing. The spindles hummed steadily and ceaselessly on all sides. With the exception of the aunt, beside whom sat only one elderly lady, who with her thin, careworn face was rather out of place in this brilliant society, the whole company had settled into three groups. One, chiefly masculine, had formed round the Abbé. Another, of young people, was grouped round the beautiful Princess Hélène, Prince Vasily's daughter, and the little Princess Bolkonskaya, very pretty and rosy, though rather too plump for her age. The third group was gathered round Mortemart and Anna Pavlovna. The Vicomte was a nice-looking young man with soft features and polished manners, who evidently considered himself a celebrity, but out of politeness modestly placed himself at the disposal of the circle in which he found himself. Anna Pavlovna was obviously serving him up as a treat to her guests. as a clever maître d'hôtel serves up as a specially choice delicacy a piece of meat that no one who had seen it in the kitchen would have cared to eat, so Anna Pavlovna served up to her guests first the vicomte and then the abbé as peculiarly choice morsels. The group about Mortemart immediately began discussing the murder of the Duc d'Enghien. Note, the Duc d'Enghien had been charged with conspiracy to assassinate Napoleon, had been found guilty, and had been executed at Vincennes on March 21, 1804. The Vicomte said that the Duc d'Enghien had perished by his own magnanimity, and that there were particular reasons for Buonaparte's hatred of him.
"Ah, yes, do tell us all about it, Vicomte," said Anna Pavlovna, with a pleasant feeling that there was something a la Louis XV in the sound of that sentence. "Contez-nous cela, Vicomte."
The Vicomte bowed and smiled courteously in token of his willingness to comply. Anna Pavlovna arranged a group round him, inviting everyone to listen to his tale.
"The Vicomte knew the Duke personally," whispered Anna Pavlovna to one of the guests. "The Vicomte is a wonderful raconteur," said she to another. "How evidently he belongs to the best society," said she to a third.
And the Vicomte was served up to the company in the choicest and most advantageous style, like a well-garnished joint of roast beef on a hot dish. The Vicomte wished to begin his story and gave a subtle smile.
"Come over here, Hélène, dear," said Anna Pavlovna to the beautiful young princess, who was sitting some way off, the center of another group.
The princess smiled. She rose with the same unchanging smile with which she had first entered the room, the smile of a perfectly beautiful woman. With a slight rustle of her white dress trimmed with moss and ivy, with a gleam of white shoulders, glossy hair, and sparkling diamonds, she passed between the men who made way for her, not looking at any of them, but smiling on all, as if graciously allowing each the privilege of admiring her beautiful figure and shapely shoulders, back, and bosom, which in the fashion of those days were very much exposed, and she seemed to bring the glamour of a ballroom with her as she moved toward Anna Pavlovna. Hélène was so lovely that not only did she not show any trace of coquetry, but on the contrary, she even appeared shy of her unquestionable and all too victorious beauty. She seemed to wish, but to be unable, to diminish its effect. "How lovely," said everyone who saw her. And the Vicomte lifted his shoulders and dropped his eyes as if startled by something extraordinary when she took her seat opposite and beamed upon him also with her unchanging smile.
"Madame, I doubt my ability before such an audience," said he, smilingly inclining his head.
The princess rested her bare round arm on a little table and considered a reply unnecessary. She smilingly waited. All the time the story was being told, she sat upright, glancing now at her beautiful round arm, altered in shape by its pressure on the table, now at her still more beautiful bosom, on which she readjusted a diamond necklace. From time to time she smoothed the folds of her dress, and whenever the story produced an effect, she glanced at Anna Pavlovna, at once adopted just the expression she saw on the maid of honor's face, and again relapsed into her radiant smile. The little princess had also left the tea-table and followed Hélène.
"Wait a moment, I'll get my work. Now then, what are you thinking of?" she went on, turning to Prince Hippolyte. "Fetch me my work-bag."
There was a general movement as the princess, smiling and talking merrily to everyone at once, sat down and gaily arranged herself in her seat.
"Now I'm all right," she said, and asking the Vicomte to begin, she took up her work.
Prince Hippolyte, having brought the work-bag, joined the circle, and, moving a chair close to hers, seated himself beside her. Le charmant Hippolyte was surprising by his extraordinary resemblance to his beautiful sister, but yet more by the fact that, in spite of this resemblance, he was exceedingly ugly. His features were like his sister's, but while in her case everything was lit up by a joyous, self-satisfied, youthful, and constant smile of animation, and by the wonderful classic beauty of her figure, his face, on the contrary, was dulled by imbecility and a constant expression of sullen self-confidence, while his body was thin and weak. His eyes, nose, and mouth all seemed puckered into a vacant, wearied grimace, and his arms and legs always fell into unnatural positions. "It's not going to be a ghost story,"
said he, sitting down beside the princess and hastily adjusting his lorgnette, as if without this instrument he could not begin to speak.
"Why, no, my dear fellow," said the astonished narrator, shrugging his shoulders. "Because I hate ghost stories," said Prince Hippolyte, in a tone which showed that he only understood the meaning of his words after he had uttered them. He spoke with such self-confidence that his hearers could not be sure whether what he said was very witty or very stupid. He was dressed in a dark green dress coat, knee breeches of the color of cuisse de nymphe effrayée, as he called it, the thigh of a frightened nymph, shoes and silk stockings. The Vicomte told his tale very neatly. It was an anecdote then current to the effect that the Duc d'Enghien had gone secretly to Paris to visit Mademoiselle Georges, that at her house he came upon Bonaparte, who also enjoyed the famous actress's favors, and that in his presence Napoleon happened to fall into one of the fainting fits to which he was subject, and was thus at the Duke's mercy. The latter spared him, and this magnanimity Bonaparte subsequently repaid by death. Note: Mademoiselle Georges appears in person later on in the novel. She was a great tragic actress who was for some years Napoleon's mistress. In 1808 she went to Petersburg, where she had much success, and it was then that Natasha heard her declaim in Hélène's salon, as described later. The story was very pretty and interesting, especially at the point where the rivals suddenly recognized one another, and the ladies looked agitated.
"Charming," said Anna Pavlovna, with an inquiring glance at the little princess.
"Charming," whispered the little princess, sticking the needle into her work, as if to testify that the interest and fascination of the story prevented her from going on with it. The Vicomte appreciated this silent praise, and smiling gratefully prepared to continue. But just then Anna Pavlovna, who had kept a watchful eye on the young man who so alarmed her, noticed that he was talking too loudly and vehemently with the abbé, so she hurried to the rescue. Pierre had managed to start a conversation with the abbé about the balance of power, and the latter, evidently interested by the young man's simple-minded eagerness, was explaining his pet theory.